Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain, Bradley Burrows, and guests.
Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode number 65. You're with myself, Paul Spain.
Nate Dunn.
And Skip Parker. Welcome along, everyone. Hope you had a great Easter. We have a big lineup of tech and gadgety related news this week. A bunch of layoffs actually out there. We talk about some New Zealand technology from the chaps at Unified Inbox. We talk about some US happenings, a bit of drama with a Trojan.
A bit of drama with the Trojan.
Just a small one.
Yeah.
No big issue.
A $1 billion acquisition. We chat about some Canadians that have been a little bit naughty. And a big announcement from Pacific Fibre. So, there's a bit more in there, but that's the bulk of it. So, guys, let's jump in. First up, we've just heard in the last couple of days about the possibility of Sony possibly laying off up to 10,000 people, as being reported in Japan at the moment. Nothing official from Sony yet. And Yahoo confirming that they will be laying off 2,000 people, which I think about 14% of their workforce. That's pretty major in the scheme of things, isn't it?
It's not a small number of people, but I mean, Yahoo need to trim down and slim down, really. I mean, they really have what, I think it's 14,000 employees running that site, or the services.
Yeah, spread out all over the world. As I was reading that article, that's incredible. They've got such a presence. Yeah, and I think they just need to get those labour costs down so they can start competing again. It's I think they've been running a bit of a glut for a wee while now.
Now, I understand that the cuts have been in the commercial sales side of things, mostly around advertising and that sort of thing, which seems to be a little bit weird in my book. Maybe they just have too many sales reps, but surely that would be one area you don't want to slice away too quickly.
Well, they have changed their business model, though, worth bearing in mind that as they've moved across to using Microsoft's Bing search engine to drive their search. Also, a lot of the advertising is being handled now by Microsoft, so they're not. They don't have to actually go out and sell that stuff. But you know, they do have other online properties and so on that they probably need to represent in some way. So yeah, that's a bit of a worry in some regards. But yeah, necessary that they lighten up.
Now, question I have is, why is Yahoo still here? I mean, do we really use it?
Well, Yahoo's always been big in the US, and I think that's where you see most of their share. You look in New Zealand, I don't know anybody that uses Yahoo as their search engine of choice. In New Zealand, it's sort of Google, and more Google, and a very, very thin slither really to Bing here. And then anything else sort of tends to come after that.
To be more of a boutique search engine. Yeah. You get that thing where people are using Google, instead of typing in the address bar, and you see it everywhere, especially with my parents and my partner especially, you'll say go to whatever, try trade me, and you'll see them jump on Google and type in trade me and then click the first result. It's incredible. They don't understand that, hold on, there's actually an address bar. There is a really short domain that you can type stuff into.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? And I guess there are so many things with technology. There's always 100 ways, there are always lots of different ways of doing something. And people just get used to using these sort of techniques.
I think it's incredible that that article saying that they're going to save about $375 million a year. That's just, you see in all these tech things, you see these big figures thrown around left, right, and center. The Instagram deal at the moment, $1 billion, but it's just massive amounts of money. It's incredible.
It's funny because the article sort of talked a little bit, one of the ones I read talked about the fact that shareholders aren't necessarily looking for cost-saving measures. They're actually looking for strategic direction on the whole thing. So it's kind of interesting you say that. I think they're pulling out the big figures to try and, shore up shareholder confidence a little bit. But, it's kind of like, well, yeah, but what is Yahoo? What does it do? I mean, it has Picasa, doesn't it?
Well, they've got a range of services. There's a whole bunch that they've actually closed down, or that have finished up. But there are certainly lots of current projects and things from Yahoo, and yeah, that's one of them. Yahoo Groups, Yahoo Finance, they've got their own email service.
Oh, don't get me started about the email service. It creates so much havoc for me in life.
Is that the one that Extra?
That is a telecom powered.
Use now for all of their for their customer email.
They basically just fob it off, is what it is. That's all it is.
But Flick is the main thing, isn't it? That Yahoo's known for. In New Zealand Picasso. Right now, isn't it?
Yep.
Picasso's the Google one.
The Google one. Just like to point out that Lycos still exists. I didn't remember back in the day when you used to use Lycos.com for searching.
I don't think I ever used them. One of the services they do own is Yahoo Babelfish, which is a translation service that was around a lot, I think, quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I think they must have, they picked that up somewhere along the way. And if I remember correctly, they also are the big... like Trade Me type service in Japan. I think that it's Yahoo that that provides that, if I remember that one correctly.
You get extra points if you can pronounce it, though. Japanese version of Trade Me. Yeah, very cool. So they are pretty extensive, but it is a bit sad to see them starting to waver off a bit, because, you know, the Facebooks, the Googles, and even Microsoft with Bing are starting to cut into that space quite a bit now.
Mm.
I think it just shows, you know, you can't be really, there's no room for complacency in any of these online offerings. It's, you know, if you're not doing it, if you're not pushing ahead, if you're not breaking those boundaries and seeing how far the technology can go, you know, just wait for a little bit and someone else will overtake you, and before you realize, you're, you know, well behind them.
Yep.
It's, you know, incredible.
And it sounds like there's the potential, as we say, we don't have anything official yet, but the potential there that Sony are going to be cutting a bunch of people as well, 10,000, which is on a much bigger scale. Then again, you know, Sony's obviously a much larger company, but that one's concerning. So we'll certainly report back if we hear a bit more on that one. Now, Nate, you alluded to a $1 billion deal. You were talking about Instagram, and it's just been announced today that Instagram, which is the service predominantly used on iPhones at the moment, but it's just come out for Android as well, for making funky and very old-looking photos with your smartphone. Just went for $1 billion.
I think last time I was on here, I was talking about how, you know, Android users, and I'm a big fan of the whole Android platform, have finally been able to get Instagram, and then they've just been bought out. And it's interesting how it's a service that you can take photos and then modify and apply filters. Like, if someone had pitched that to me as software, I would have thought, oh well, you know, that's a nice sort of interesting app, but never would have thought there'd be actually any value in it. And I was also reading a blog post, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about how it's not actually available on all the Android platforms, and it was the blog was a particular one about the iPhone and how with the iPhone having the set hardware right across, you know, they've got the one device, and it's the fragmentation of Android, you know, is actually not a really good thing when you're trying to develop apps that'll work across everything. So
yeah, I mean, it's only just come out on Android, hasn't it? But as a platform, the fact that there are so many variants of Android and so many different types of devices does make it hard from a developer perspective, for sure.
Yeah, because I was also looking at I think it was Hulu or Netflix or one of the services to run on my tablet, and again, there's a very small amount of I think it was Hulu, a very small amount of tablets that it actually supports, and they're finding that they're having to have all these different variations for all the different manufacturers and all the different hardware. So, I suppose that's where the fragmentation of Android really doesn't work that well.
No, it definitely creates the odd challenge, shall we say. So, yeah, thinking about that, now Instagram, off the top of my head, had about 30 million users, is that accurate?
25 million, I think.
Okay.
25 or 27 million.
But let's say
that that was just off their iOS install base. What they found is the day they went to Android, they had 1 million users added to that base on the first day, in the first 24 hours, and they were tipped to head well towards 50 million users with the Android base. And there has been some speculation that perhaps Facebook's move to buy the company at twice its market value, its perceived market value, because it's only really valued at $500 million at a push, was because they were concerned of the massive growth that Instagram had gone in terms of user base. And there's sort of a discussion about whether Instagram could be called a social network space itself. It still lacks a bit. There's no advertising there. There's no revenue model behind it. It is just a bit of an odd one, but I guess the revenue model is just being brought out for $1 billion.
Yeah, well, I'm reading here they are talking about 30 million users. Now, if you actually calculate that out based on the current user bases, now, bearing in mind this is a free service, what they're saying is every single user is worth to Instagram $30 a piece. Now, I wish I had known that you could sell things like this. Back in the day where I launched my social network, World DJ, we grew that to 300,000 members. And if I'd been able to sell those for $30 a piece, that would have been 10 million greenbacks hanging out of my back pocket. But never mind. We learn these lessons on what can be done if you plug into the right people that have got lots of money and want to throw it around.
It'd be interesting to see with this acquisition how Facebook take that platform and integrate it with their... their whole photo site, because I know that the Facebook photo, which is a Facebook app, is the largest photo repository of photos anywhere in the world. So in my mind, them taking out Instagram makes sense.
They Facebook announced they were going to keep it separate as a separate company, but I mean
for now
exactly. Mm-hmm. But Instagram 12 employees.
$1 billion.
So that spreads quite nicely amongst the team, I thought.
Yeah, that'd buy a lot of Marmite, wouldn't it?
Yep. Oh, sorry, 13 employees. I was slightly wrong there, but still, one extra employee, it's $1 billion, It's all good.
I think it's a good showcase that, to build a $1 billion company, you don't necessarily need to have, global offices everywhere and thousands of staff and all this infrastructure. You can just take an idea, do it very, very well, and then just hold out for the right buyer.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That actually does seem to be quite a few companies' business strategies these days now. Wait for Microsoft, Google, or Apple to buy them out, or Facebook, as it seems.
Yeah.
Now onto a local story. There's a company we've chatted to over the last little while called Unified Inbox, and you can look these guys up at unifiedinbox.com, and they've got some pretty cool concepts around better and smarter handling of email. Now, we expect to be getting together with them over the next little while to see a little bit more of their product. But if you go to unifiedinbox.com right now, there is a YouTube video up there that shows you some of the smart bits and pieces they have with a unified archive system, special filtering rules, and other things that are really designed to make email a more useful platform, both for individuals and operating in a group type scenario. So, yeah, some quite cool little add-ons and bits and pieces that are in their system. And yeah, I think this stuff's got quite a bit of potential.
So, is this designed for like a support desk for you've got 10 or 15 employees that are all looking after support at mycompany.co.nz, and then
I think it's designed really broadly. So it's something that individuals could use, but also can be used in those sort of group scenarios for teams and so on.
Yeah, because I was watching the video before, and I think the classic providers, if you ever email, I think it's one of the car companies, possibly Thrifty, and they've got a very sort of hodgepodge way they all share. Must be like an IMAP email account, and that's the first company I thought straight away that this would be a perfect solution for them. And I can think too that it would fit well. If you're a small company, you've got one person on support desk. All of a sudden, you get very, very busy. You've got 3 or 4 more staff. You could get the software, and I really like the fact that you can. I was watching this video before. You can assign particular emails to people that have got expertise in possibly that area. So instead of having to sort of yell across the office, across the cubicles, you can actually have something a little bit smarter and a little bit better.
Yeah, it certainly makes a lot of sense. So we'll report back a little bit on more on that These guys are really attracting quite a bit of attention internationally. There's quite a bit of a story to tell. We just wanted to give that a bit of a mention this week, and we will come back to it shortly. And you know, we love it when New Zealand startups come up with great things and launch them internationally. It's always a really good thing to see. Now, something else came across was US are changing some of their laws that will sort of make it legal for individuals and organisations to have their own unmanned drones flying around the place. Did you guys catch up on this one?
Oh, it's incredible! What a scary thought that you'd just be walking around and you hear this as it flies ahead, thinking, "Oh, I wonder if that was a Google drone, or was that one of the Department of Defense?" Or,
well, I guess there's. I mean, I think we talked on one of the earlier shows that these sort of things are starting to appear, and the police in some parts of the US are using them now. I think Brad said he saw a police drone fly over when he was in Seattle a few months ago. So these things are becoming a reality. Obviously, there are parts of the world that are at war, and these things are a very scary reality in those places because they, you know, they have the potential to come in and destroy you.
Mm.
But yeah, these surveillance type drones and so on, I think are have a scary side to them too, right?
I suppose the straight away the example, like the New Zealand example, I could think of that would actually be a good proof of this technology would be flying it over, I don't know, the Coromandel, looking for all the marijuana plantations that are hidden around, rather than commissioning, you know, I think it was on the news last week where they actually use Army Iroquois, I think it was, and they fly the police around. You know, if you had a droid like this, you could actually pinpoint the exact GPS location.
So are you suggesting this for individuals who are trying to get a drug stash for themselves or for the police?
No, I'm suggesting this for the police.
Did I see you place an order for a drone just recently this week?
Just you could, assuming that the drone's running cost would be a lot lower than, you know, getting someone from the army through, you could use it to fight that whole war on drugs.
I reckon search and rescue is the one key. You know how you hear search and rescue efforts have been shut down for the night because it's too cold or whatever? Mm. Drones can just keep flying. I mean, those are sort of areas that I reckon it can work really well. But I'm just a little bit concerned that they might be arming drones in the metropolitan area, you know, sitting there getting an Exocet missile up your backside for a traffic infringement or something. It could be a bit concerning.
Well, yeah, they probably wind down the severity for a first infringement, though, Skip. It's that third infringement that you should be most worried about.
Do you think they'll ever, you know how Wellington had that whole car parking car that was going around, you know, being overly heavily handed about, you know, if you stop for 10 or 15 minutes, they would give you a ticket. Would they have a Wellington City Council droid that would, you know, no, fly around? And
it wouldn't work. You'd be crashing into buildings all the time. There's so many buildings in downtown Wellington. And it's so windy, it'd probably never get off the ground.
Well, they'd get up there and then they'd just get blown into the side of a building or something, right? So, sorry to our Wellington listeners.
I don't know. There's a bit of a love affair with drones because they seem to have this perceived cost-saving value on it. So it's kind of like, you know what? Yep, it's going to be cheaper to run. But I just look at it and go, yeah, you know what? You've got that cheaper Taiwanese-built drone flying around the city. How many things are going to go wrong? And to be honest, I mean, I've seen the large Predator drones that they use in the US military up close. I mean, it's as big as a jet. They're not small aircraft.
Mm. No, they're
some of them are
huge.
Small, but the general ones that are doing the real serious work are big aircraft. So let's just busy up the skies.
And they're
skies
worth millions of dollars. They're probably not, or you know, they're not something that we'll probably see around our, you know, local townships anytime soon.
No, that's right.
Good. All right. Well, there we go. That's enough of my fascination with drones and robots for the evening. Now,
I think the website, if you're interested in that, is go to diydrone.com, I think is the site.
Okay.
You can actually make your own drones with your own remote control aircraft because it's all Arduino-based kits, and you can unfortunately build your own drone for less than a couple of $100.
Well, there we go.
Plug them into your computer and map it out and get it to see if it actually flies the course.
Well, if anyone gives it a go, definitely drop us a line. We like to hear about those kind of cool homegrown or, you know, homemade type projects.
I think my day's tomorrow sorted. I'm going to go and build a drone. Fly it outside Skip's window.
Now, there was some really big news over the weekend, and I guess the news was in the numbers, and what we're talking about is the flashback malware that's been floating around on the Mac since 2011. Actually, it's been floating around for some time in various iterations. But the news came out that they're now estimating that 600,000 Macs have been infected with this malware. Now, that's pretty a pretty large percentage in the scheme of things, isn't it?
Compared to the claim that Macs can't get viruses, yes.
Well, I think, and we've talked about it on the show a lot, whatever system you've got, you should protect it with appropriate antivirus, anti-malware type software. And, I think this is probably, just a good reminder that when we say that, we're not just making it up. There is a genuine reason that any technology platform has risks associated in terms of being able to catch, or get hit by vulnerabilities.
And in a very much in a corporate environment, you can never be lax about your security. And it's not a sort of thing where, you set up your firewall or whatever, network rules and go, great, that's me done. It's a constant evolving task, and you can never be complacent about it because it will just come back and bite you.
Yeah, for sure. My big concern is that there is still a little bit stuck in the midness, shall we say, from Apple on this platform. They still say, they're starting to introduce antivirus for the Mac operating system, but you still have a lockdown feature set on the iPhone. So, in theory, you can never get a virus on the iPhone. Well, that's what you said about the Macs, guys. So perhaps there's going to be a little bit of a soul-searching exercise at Apple, especially, just to say, well, maybe there is the possibility that there's some problems and we need to open this up, because I know that there are a number of really good antivirus solutions for the Mac operating system that work very, very well with corporate and private stuff. So that's cool. And it's not a bad thing to say that your operating system does have the occasional flaw. Everyone has it. It's just actually it's been quite surprising how long it's taken for Mac to actually have this occur.
Yeah, I mean, there have been things over the years. I remember something used to spread between Macs on floppy disks. Going back, over 20 years ago. So, there have been security, issues around on the various versions of Mac operating systems since almost year dot.
But not according to Apple Corporate. And that's, I think, where the dangerous parts come into an organization that says, you know what, we're not going to approve antivirus software into our platforms because we don't believe we're vulnerable.
Yeah, well, they did change the tune last year, and they've built in some of that sort of at an operating system level, which is good. I think what Apple play on, their tagline is Macs don't get PC viruses. They don't get Windows viruses unless you're running Windows on your Mac. But a Mac is a personal computer, and in fact this latest particular issue that we're seeing takes advantage of a Java security hole, and Java's certainly across platform type technology. Although in this case, it is a very specific, it's a Mac specific issue. So, yeah, definitely. Just really, I think a reminder to all of our listeners is to be cautious and careful around your security. Now, another thing that sort of ties in, I guess, in line with this, is also to be cautious about your mobile platforms and actually how you use them. And the latest one we've heard of is, this has been public for a little while as well. Is the vulnerability of certain apps on iPhone and on other platforms that can potentially leak information that you have either on your phone or on your email server. So one of the latest ones is around the Facebook application on iPhone, and
Dropbox as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Dropbox, and them not, I guess, yeah, leaving really critical data unencrypted on your phone, so someone could use that to access a, you know, a whole lot of stuff that they shouldn't.
Because a perfect front for that would be to create an app that, you know, a flickering candle or a flame or something, and the user goes, oh, that's really, really pretty, but in the actual background it's going, you know, it knows where those configuration files are. They're in plain text, so they don't have to do any work, and it fires it off to some site where they can then pull down all your files. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that are storing a lot of sensitive stuff on Dropbox. And, yep, you know, if those passwords got out, they would be stuffed.
Yeah, yeah. Not a good position. And we've, you know, heard in the last few months there was you know, a situation with apps on the iPhone that had access to your location information, and it turned out actually those apps were able to draw that out of your photos, but they were also actually able to access your entire photo collection on your phone as well, and potentially upload those to another location. So, you know, these sorts of things are going on behind the scenes on smartphone platforms, unbeknownst to a lot of users. The other one was the contact sync, where you would allow an app access to your contacts so that it could, you know, maybe, you know, match up your friends and so on. But there were a bunch of apps that were then taking all your contacts and uploading them to their server. So not just accessing them on your phone, but running off with all that data and storing them elsewhere.
It's such a bad way for apps to do that. Like, you know, with the proliferation of a thing called OAuth, which all the big sites like Facebook, Twitter, Flickr use. And for anyone that's not familiar with it, the OAuth's quite a complicated protocol. But what, in essence, what happens is when you authorize an app to get access to your data, you don't give the app your username and password. What you end up giving it is a token. And then the nice thing is that because you've got the app's only got that token, they don't have access to anything else, is if something rogue does happen, you can log into that Twitter service or Facebook, revoke that token, and then that app's gone. So it is a fantastic plan. It's very complicated. You know, as a developer, I loathe it because it's ridiculously complicated to implement and use. However, you know, these big services should be really enforcing that. And if you want to develop an app for our service, that's fine, but you've got to use OAuth or a similar protocol to be able to do it.
Agreed. Yeah. No, it's not really a good position, some of these security issues, and especially when they're coming from really, really big software vendors. I think that's extremely, extremely poor. But, you know, it's just another reminder of the complexity of software. And we look at technology today and sometimes think everything's so easy. Oh, I can get myself up and running with a email account and a smartphone. Like, I could get my whole, you know, I could launch a new business and tomorrow set up all the IT for it myself. And, you know, you forget there's actually many risks and complexities to just doing these things on an ad hoc basis.
Yep.
All right. Now, next up, we've had some issues around Auckland recently with some card skimming and you know, a bit of scams going on there with people losing quite a bit of money out of their bank accounts.
I think I'd go back to the example that the issue that happened. Was it 2 or 3 years ago where one of the downtown car parks had issues with their their pay and display units. Only reason I know is because my card was one that got taken.
I think mine was too. Yeah.
And then it ended up taking them, was it a year or 18 months to actually get the system back up and going again?
Longer.
It took ages. I mean, you basically were cash only in
two or three years. Yeah.
And they never revealed where the vulnerability is, but I reckon that it was an employee who downloaded the files from the units and then sent them away. I don't actually reckon that any of the encryption got, if there was encryption between the sites, was ever compromised. So, you know, it's sort of this, oh, here we go again with skimming. So
I guess there's always a lot of possibilities in those cases, and you know, they're not obliged to share that information with the current laws in New Zealand, but I hear they've caught some Canadian scammers.
Mm.
Yeah. They're actually before the courts. So, I mean, I think it's positive news to know that these, you know, dodgy things that go on aren't in every case something that, you know, doesn't actually get dealt with, and that, you know, there is an opportunity for, you know, for the scammers to be hit.
this is the tip of the iceberg, honestly. I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. This is a bigger crime, organized crime cash gatherer than drugs itself now globally. There's a lot cleaner to do, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts. We are only going to see, this is only the tip of it for New Zealand. We're going to see a lot more of this coming through, for sure. Because it's happening in Australia. We get, there's a sort of a, anecdotally, they talk about the international world hacking tours where people go on trips through countries doing the skimming and the scamming type thing, getting the funds transferred or the details transferred to another part of the world, and they transfer the cash out that at that point, so it's hard to track back. But they, yeah, they're doing it all around the world. It's easy for them to do. Go to a country, skim it as much as they can, and then move to the next country. So I think we're actually going to see a lot more of this in New Zealand, unfortunately.
Are you guys amazed? I'm impressed with the bank's response to this. You know, my feelings about banks are not amazing. But the fact that, you know, the banks have stood up straight away and said, hey, look, you know, obviously this is a problem, and we're going to look after you and actually cover you. I'm amazed that the banks haven't said, well, I'm really sorry, but you're on your own.
No, I mean, they have to give confidence in these systems, otherwise the whole, you know, the whole process would fall apart. So they've got to, you know, allow people to be confident in the credit cards and the, you know, gadgets and so on they're giving out. They don't want everyone to say, well, I want a printed little booklet like we used to have 30 years ago that shows my balance in it, and when I come into my bank and make a manual transaction, you can update that. You know, it's in their interests, and it's they save so much money through all the electronic transactions that they wouldn't want, you know, people to be running scared, I suppose.
Because yeah. I know ASB have started putting in anti-skimming devices at their ATMs. The last one was the protrusion from that where you put the card in, it sticks right out so
the
you can see.
The green ones, yeah.
And the latest thing is they've got a really annoying flap that sort of hangs over where the keypad is, so you've got to sort of like lift it up, and you can only just get your hand in to put the digits in. So the idea is if there is a camera above, you know, it's not going to be able to record your numbers.
Oh, okay. Haven't seen that one yet. That must be new.
Yeah, I've seen that. But, yeah. I mean, the weakest point's going to be not so much the cash machines, because I think they're going to tighten up quite a lot. It's going to be retail operations. So it's going in and it's replacing the old K21 keypads and that sort of stuff with a skimming hacked device, which still operates like a normal keypad. But, I mean, they've seen this overseas. So I reckon in terms of retail stores, that's going to be the next weakest point.
Yeah, I'm amazed with, you know, I'm a merchant. I've got a merchant account with a bank. I would never purchase FBOSS equipment. You know, the technology is so changing so often. The security is getting better and better. You know, we own our point of sale, but we don't own any of the FBOSS equipment, because as soon as something new and better comes out, we can then get it swapped straight out. And there's no massive investment in capital and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's great.
And I may actually kill an industry by saying this, but if you're buying your FBOSS machine off Trade Me, you might just be in the Muppet Brigade, to be honest. Because you just don't know about that. Go to a place that is actually reputable to do your FPOS stuff. Don't just go to, you know, Kiwi 21 or whatever off Trade Me and buying the unit from there, because you don't have any history as to who that person is.
Who knows? It might be tracking every transaction and firing all the details off and the credit card details. And yeah, it's not smart, is it?
No. There's even the things, you know, I know when I was looking at particular terminals that, you know, and as a merchant, you don't know about this, but some terminals are so old that they won't take the new upgrades of software. So you could actually end up buying a terminal that will work, but as soon as there's another big upgrade, you know, you're going to have to buy another
again.
One.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Now, something that's been of interest to us since the podcast launched is, and I guess a bit of a concern has been the limitations for New Zealand in access to international internet traffic. And you know, for the past well, many years, we've had really just one you know, one primary provider of bandwidth to New Zealand. That's been the Southern Cross undersea fiber optic cables, but there is another player that has been looking to come into the market. And right now we're going to jump across to an interview with the CEO of Pacific Fibre, Mark Rushworth. Right now we're chatting with Mark Rushworth, who's the CEO of Pacific Fibre here in New Zealand. Mark, welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, Pacific Fibre, can you share a little bit about what Pacific Fibre is about and why Pacific Fibre is important to those of us in New Zealand and Australia?
Absolutely. Look, the genesis of the idea really comes back to around about 3.5 years ago, where a couple of guys, Sam Morgan, Rod Jury, were commenting in the media around, I guess, misguided government expenditure in fibre to the home. And you kind of go, well, why misguided? Really, the idea is around the problem that we have in the case of New Zealand with data caps. Comes down to the fact that we have a sole provider for our international bandwidth. Now, why is that relevant? Well, 80%, actually it's higher, about 85% of the content we consume in New Zealand comes from the States or via the States if it's coming from Europe. And so the idea back then was, well, if you're building a super fiber highway, 5 lanes up and down New Zealand, you know, it doesn't get you very far because 80% of the content we consume comes offshore. And there is that sole cable, Southern Cross, great cable, been there for 10 years, but, and we all know as consumers, when there is only one of something as a supplier, we tend to be paying more than we should.
Sure. Yeah. Bit of a problem.
Than other markets. So we kind of looked at that and, diving into that, we realized actually the demand for bandwidth has been doubling about the last 5 years, doubling every couple of years, so growing at kind of 55% per annum. And I'll come back to some of the drivers for that demand side. And then we looked at, well, supply, you've got monopoly situation in New Zealand, you've got a duopoly in Australia. But then we dived in underneath and looked at actual supply arrangements. And even though you can upgrade subsea cables by putting some fancy shiny equipment on each end, there is kind of an end of life in terms of how much capacity you can squeeze out of them.
Yeah, there are limits, aren't there? Because the fibre optic cable that gets laid initially, that's the main limiting factor, isn't it?
Correct. It's the once the fibre's in the water, you can repair it, but you can't change the fibre itself. More importantly, about every and it depends on the total length of the cable, but every 80K you put in a big repeater, which basically takes a signal, cleans it up, and sends it down to the next repeater. And the distance you space those determines what the overall maximum capacity you can get. So once it's in the water, what you tend to do then is to get more capacity out of your system, you put different optical gear on each end that over time squeezes more and more capacity out of it. But New Zealand and Australia, there's a supply constraint coming on board 2018, and we looked at the market and said, oh, well, there's a very profitable market here for international bandwidth. There's room for a third player to make a market entry that is carrier neutral and independent from the big telcos. That's where the Pacific Fibre business really started on the back of. And that was, 2 years ago we started. And here we are today.
So, that's quite interesting. You talk about 2018, that when we're potentially hitting, a supply constraint issue. That's quite a long way ahead to look. And I guess that's one of the challenges for Pacific Fibre as a business in terms of getting financing and funding and all of those things. It's a fairly long-term view people have to take of such an investment, I imagine.
Well, you're right, I guess. It's a critical piece of infrastructure, and infrastructure, dams, electricity tend to have longer life than physical life of this, which is 25 years.
Yeah.
The challenge that you have, and this is where we have been very successful over the last 18 months, is working with anchor customers and securing their commitment, support, and binding contracts, and doing it where the supply that they're going to get off you is still 2 years away. And so, getting a major telco to lift where their vision's, you know, next quarter or next half year results. So look out that far and commit to a contract, which, you know, in some cases, the majority of ours are 10-year contracts. The longest one goes up to 23 years.
Wow.
So for us, it kind of, I guess, confirms the fact that, you know, there's strong appetite for another cable serving the region. People want to see a competitive market ahead of each respective government's investment in fibre to the home. Because without a competitive market for international bandwidth and still having restrictive data caps, neither country will realise the true benefits of what fibre can offer if we're still sitting on constrained 5-gig data plans.
Agreed, yep. So what is it that Pacific Fibre has announced today? It was, I think, you know, looking at the various announcements from Pacific Fibre since the beginning, today would have to be one of the most significant ones.
Well, they're all, you know, hugely important, particularly when we announce new customers. So today we announced a fifth anchor customer, a US telecommunications company. And so now we have $200 million US dollars worth of contracted revenue across these five customers, which, you know, $200 million US is a lot of revenue.
Well, that's a fairly big chunk of what you need to build the cable. Is that right?
Well, it is. We can't quite look at it as in, this is equity that goes towards the build. But it certainly gives the equity investors confidence in the business plan, validates that demand side, demonstrates that there are customers that are willing to support a cable so far out from being built, you know, 2 years out from being built, and customers across New Zealand, you know, Australia and the US. It's always going to be easier getting support out of New Zealand, where in New Zealand, you know, there's only the single provider, Southern Cross.
Sure.
But it's great to get the likewise support from US and Australia.
Yeah, that's great. Now, there's probably been one or two of us that have been, it's been a while between announcements that have wondered whether Pacific Fibre can get together sort of sufficient funding to pull this off. But, you know, having that commitment of contracted revenue, you've also announced today that you expect to be in a position of sort of finalising all those funding agreements. I think it's in the sort of mid-June type timeframe.
That's right.
Something you're pretty confident of?
Oh, absolutely. You know, 100% confidence that we'll get this away on the back of those customer contracts. And, you know, if anything, and we've said previously, I've said before that, look, it's been a lot harder and taken a lot longer than we initially thought. We looked at a number of different options of debt and equity. We're working with a few investors in particular that like infrastructure type assets, and what the $200 million of customer sales does is it provides a surety, or provides a minimum level of return for those equity investors. And that's what they like to see. They like to see, you know, any perceived market risk or downsides mitigated, and
sure,
having that level of sales, it achieves that. So
good.
It's, kind of good milestone. That gives us confidence to put mid-June as the date when we expect to have financing completed, and gives us confidence to, you know, set a ribbon-cutting date in Sydney for July 2014 when the first packets of data will be sent over the new Pacific Fibre cable.
Yeah, I think that's pretty exciting. I mean, it seems a long way off, but now you've got all those other things in place. I know we've heard one or two other dates in the past of when Pacific Fibre might be launched. Is that something now that's
going to be pretty solid in terms of we can expect this to be something that's available in 2014. And presuming that happens, what's you know, when will consumers start seeing the flow-on effect?
Well, we signed T-Subcom as our vendor last year, and you know, they're the leading expert in the industry for subsea deployment. It's a turnkey solution with them, so confident that they can you know, deliver in that 2-year build window. The actual cable deployment itself is relatively easy to do. You know, this cable, which is 13,000 kilometres in length, is the thickness of a garden hose, and it lies on the sea floor. It's just popped over the back of the boat. For areas where the depth of the water, particularly as it comes into New Zealand, where it's less than 1,500 metres, the ship uses what's called a sea plough. That is much like a plough you use in the garden behind a horse, and it buries the... makes a small trench of about a, you know, school roller, 30 centimetre roller, and then covers it over and buries the cable at about, you know, 1.5 metres below the seafloor. And that just protects it from things like ship anchors and fishing nets and all those various bits that cables don't like. So we've got T-Subcom, as I say, to do that that deployment. 2014 is July when we've got it earmarked for delivery. That is it's about a 3-month slip on. We had Q1 in 2014 for it to be delivered.
Sure.
And we've just pushed that out on the back that it's taken us longer to bring all the financing together. But you know, and then what we'll start to see on the back of that, I guess, will be different in different markets. But what I would expect over time, to really see some, you know, fibre plans, broadband plans in the market that have higher data caps, that are perhaps more in line with what you see in Europe, US, even Australia has significantly higher data caps than what we get to enjoy in New Zealand. Otherwise, of course, if we don't see bigger data caps on fibre, then if fibre is meant to be 10 times the speed of, you know, what we see on broadband today, and, you know, people burn through their data cap on broadband in about 20 days, you'll be doing the same on fibre with over a weekend, and then you'll be needing to buy more, which will be, I guess, there won't really be any incentive to move through to fibre there, because most of the times you'll be speed constrained to speeds of broadband or dial-up.
Yeah, so
we really need that competitive market.
Yeah. So I guess it brings us into a position, you know, like we see in Australia, where it's sort of a, you know, 1,000 gig or terabyte type data caps, or you know, or even bigger, become you know, reasonably affordable at that consumer type level, and also to you know, small to medium businesses that you know, at this stage may not be able to afford to you know, leverage the internet as much as what they could if we were paying a lot less for that international traffic.
Oh, exactly. If you probably go back, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, most people were on dial-up plans about that stage, and you know, we were happy doing a little bit of email and occasionally logging into the World Wide Web. You know, we may have consumed then on average probably about, I don't know, 80 to 100 meg of data. Now, with broadband, consumers are, you know, chewing through 5 to 6 gig on average, with your real heavy users, you know, using well over 100 gig a month. Fibre to the home, you do need those levels of data caps that you talk about in Australia. Yeah. You know, 1,000 gig, that kind of stuff. If you are going to you know, realize the real benefits that fibre can offer to businesses and to consumers.
Yeah, well, it's nice to see Orcon have you know, announced their UFB plans with a plan at that 1,000 gig size. But at the moment, you know, obviously the cost of delivering that is a lot more than what most consumers are probably comfortable paying. But yeah, it's
how's that priced? Is it kind of, it should be about $80, shouldn't it?
when you guys do your magic, that's certainly what we're hoping to see.
Well, we are all expecting that, yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're seeing at the moment is that starts at $199, you know, at their lower end UFB speeds. But it's good, you know, it's good to see that in place. And you know, their business offering, I think, is $419 plus GST. So yeah, those are things that we haven't had in the market before. And yeah, we certainly need more of it. Now, something I think will be of interest to listeners is what will happen if their ISP is connecting through Pacific Fiber, and you know, somebody does put an anchor through your cable. What would be the impact on them in that sort of situation?
Depending on what deal they've signed, the majority of ISPs would be signing with us supply agreements that provide protection. So what that means is that we will have alternate paths. So other cables in the region that we have either swapped or purchased capacity on, so that we effectively, although we're building a single string cable, we will be able to look and feel like a ring configuration network or a matrix network. So if one side of our cable goes down, traffic can be diverted across onto an alternate path while we, repair the cable and then swap the traffic back.
Excellent.
So we'll be able to offer, you know, protected products if the ISPs, you know, choose to purchase that.
Right, right. So that provides a bit of peace of mind out there. And, I mean, these situations, you know, have certainly happened overseas with various things, and, you know, there's been a number of them over the last few years. What's the typical time that it takes to get one of those sort of repairs in place? I seem to recall, you know, it's, you know, considering, you know, how far down these cables are and so on, it's it doesn't seem to take too long, maybe a week or two off the top of my head. Is that
It all depends where the break is, obviously. You know, for this region, there'll be ships up in Noumea, so it can take up to a week to get to the, you know, the location where the fault is or the break. Fixing it can be pretty quick, you know, 3 days, 5 days. And then, so you might be down for, you know, 2 weeks.
Right,
Depends on weather as well. Now, the region we're in is very benign. You know, we don't have a lot of faults in this region, thankfully. Most of the breaks are caused by human intervention, so a ship dragging its anchor or someone out fishing in a place that they shouldn't be, you know, fishing. So Auckland has, as an example, has two cable protection zones, one out of Murawai and the other one out of Takapuna, where...
Yeah, I saw the line on the map when we were out last night, actually, and yeah.
You're not allowed to fish there. You get fines, you know, $200 instant fine if you're caught fishing in the areas. So, and that, you know, that protects... But you go somewhere like Singapore, and you just need to look out in the Singapore harbour, and there are hundreds of ships anchored. And over there, they have, you know, the garden hose suddenly turns into a fire hose with armored plating. You know, it's buried 3 meters under the seabed. And so there's different ways of protecting it. But there's always, you know, if you're trying to protect against human error, then there'll be some form of stupidity that does something you weren't anticipating. But, you know, pretty rapid turnaround to fix because, you know, critical infrastructure, all of these cables.
Great. Oh, well, thanks very much for your time, Mark. It's actually been fascinating, and I think timely for us to get a bit of an update on what's happening with Pacific Fibre. And you know, I think everyone's excited about the potential of what ultra fast broadband will bring into their homes. But a key part of that picture is being able to access the international flow of traffic at an affordable price. And it sounds like you guys are really a key to making that happen here. So yeah, really, really looking forward to hearing things get finalised and the impact that's going to have on the market.
Fantastic. Look, thanks for the opportunity to come on the show and tell you all about the Pacific Fibre.
Brilliant.
Look forward to being around 2014.
Right, so before we end the show, I just want to revisit QuickFlix. Now, this was a topic last week. QuickFlix, of course, launched into the New Zealand market with an offering that in some ways compares to Netflix, but in other ways is extremely different. Now, guys, over the last few days, we've all had a chance to have a little bit of a look or a bit more of a look at QuickFlix. What are sort of the big impressions?
I really like the fact that you've got the ISPs getting on board, like Orcon, Slingshot are zero rating data, and especially if you're watching online video and in HD, it sucks a lot of your caps. So the fact you can get a zero rate is fantastic. The big moan I have about them is they've just got no content. If you look at your Hulu or your Netflix, QuickFlix is miles behind.
Yeah, I'd echo the same.
Yeah, I think that's the major issue at the moment. The other issue I have is with the zero-rated data caps is it is with the smaller internet providers, and there are reasons why a lot of people like to actually be with a bigger provider. And, yeah, I guess it's a bit of a pity that none of the big providers, the biggest providers have jumped on board. Orcon, yep, they're pretty sizable. So that's good, but it would be good to see some of the other ones jump on board, such as Vodafone, Telstra Clear, and Telecom. I think if any of those jumped on board, would be a good thing. Chances of it happening?
Zero.
So that's the flip side of it. Now, something interesting. When we were chatting last week, we were highlighting that accessing QuickFlix, you can do through Sony devices, TVs, Blu-ray players, and the PS3, but not through the Xbox yet. And Xbox has really become a real internet entertainment platform. Interesting little bit of info that I dug up was that it appears to be the reason why QuickFlix hasn't landed on Xbox is that Foxtel, who TV cable provider in the Australian market, signed an exclusive deal in the Australian market. I think about maybe 12 to 18 months ago. So that deal probably will expire at some stage this year. So there is a possibility of QuickFlix, if they've got enough funding, to be able to get some sort of deal to have placement on the Xbox in the future. So we'll wait and see on that one. But it's nice to know that it technically would be feasible for something like that to happen in the future.
It's actually nice to have a, as you can complain about the things that QuickFlix doesn't have or does have, it's nice to actually have a streaming service in New Zealand instead of having to do all the VPN trickery or proxy trickery. So hopefully they're going to have some good people behind them, they're going to expand their library of content, and they'll actually be a good runner to Sky, because really at the moment, if you want to have something in your home where you're not having to go out to get DVDs or whatever, Sky is really the only option you've got.
You mean you've managed to watch all of the Shortland Street episodes on TVNZ on demand?
I don't want to admit that, but maybe.
All right, no, it is good news, and we would certainly encourage listeners to jump on board, try out QuickFlix, give it a go. And yeah, certainly if you find that the more content doesn't come through, then hey, you may want to unplug. But we encourage people to get on board, because that's how it's going to be able to grow its content base as it grows in subscribers. All right, well, that's us for episode 65. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. You can, of course, find us online, nztechpodcast.com, facebook.com/nztechpodcast. We like to be liked on there. If you're in that sort of mood.
We like to be liked.
We do. We love it. We love being liked.
Please like us.
Please. So, yeah, feel free to jump on board. I think we've got about 1,600 of our listeners that are that have jumped on board and given us that support on Facebook. So thank you very much. Twitter as well. There's a good percentage of you now that are following us on Twitter. So you can find us there at NZ Tech Podcast. And individually, if you want to follow any of us listening as, if you want to follow any of us, Nate, what's your handle?
Nice and simple. It's just Nate. Probably the shortest Twitter handle in the whole of the country, I think.
It's an awesome Twitter handle.
It's pretty impressive. And I'm Urban Kiwi NZ.
Thanks, Skip. And my one, very easy, just my name, Paul Spain. So, track us down online. And, feel free to hit us up on email as well. Drop messages to feedback@nztechpodcast.com. So thanks, everyone. We will catch you next week on the NZ Tech Podcast.